The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening to the Town Hall Review podcast, where we bring you the best voices on the stories and issues that matter. Our podcast is brought to you through partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Here's another piece that I trust you'll enjoy.
Sarah Rankin is director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University's Law School. And she says that right now, this constant increase in spending is just creating a bigger homelessness problem. And I think she's right about that. But she says there are three approaches that actually could make a difference. Professor Rankin, thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a real pleasure. You sketch out three approaches that you believe could be more cost effective and actually could make a difference in addressing homelessness. Can you outline them quickly?
Yes, I can. First, I'd like to say, just to put a finer point on the comment you made, I don't actually have a problem with investing more in addressing homelessness. I think that affordable housing is an important priority. The alternatives that we look at in our reports that we've released this year are intended to be interim solutions while cities better gear themselves to address the lack of affordable housing. And so that's an important context. The reports that we're looking at that offer those sorts of interim solutions include accessory dwelling units in residential backyards, authorized encampments, the use of faith communities, better partnering with faith communities, and safe parking programs for vehicle residents.
Okay, let's break these down one by one, because I think that the accessory dwelling units, we spoke about this yesterday, I believe, regarding the Los Angeles County, where it's also under discussion and a big push for it. We're talking about little cottages or little tiny houses set up in your backyard. How would you encourage residents to welcome some homeless people into the backyard?
Well, it's the important thing for each city to look at first is whether they can loosen their zoning regulations in order to make these things happen. Typically, what needs to happen is cities need to adjust their laws so that those sorts of interventions are going to be more realistic. But what we've done here in Seattle, for example, is our block project is one of those programs here in Seattle, and it's been quite successful. Most of the other
To explain that.
Mm-hmm. It's been quite successful because there's a long list of people who have signed up to host folks who are formerly homeless or who would have otherwise been homeless to live in their backyard.
Okay, wait. Would people be camping in tents, or would you and would people get any compensation for hosting a homeless individual or family in the backyard?
So it depends on each of the different projects in these different cities. Each have different plans and features, and our report looks at the different ways that different cities are choosing to approach this problem.
Now, when you say there's been a tremendous response of people who want to welcome a new homeless neighbor in the backyard, by the way, would you welcome homeless folks in your backyard?
Yes, I would. I would.
Uh-huh. Have you ever in the past? But do you haven't been allowed because of zoning?
Well, zoning issues are a big problem. The program here in Seattle has a waiting list, as I understand it, of people who want to have these units built into their backyards. And other case studies are being undertaken in Colorado, California, and Oregon, all along the West Coast, with different features, both in terms of how the designs, the structures will be designed, how the projects will be funded, how residents and hosts will be screened and matched.
And by the way, other than this long waiting list, when you say there's a long waiting list, how many people are we talking about who have stepped forward and said, I want an accessory dwelling unit in my backyard to house homeless people?
You'd have to ask the Block Project for the latest number, but I know that each of these projects, this is a very innovative, cutting-edge solution.
It certainly is. Could I'm just going to put a call out. If people listening across the country, if you're one of these people who would welcome an accessory dwelling unit in your backyard to help house homeless people, if you're one of those good-hearted, generous folks, give us a call, 1-800-955-1776. Now, look, we're not going to respond, and all of a sudden, tomorrow, you're going to find some homeless folks in your backyard. I'm just interested because I honestly, maybe it's a failure of imagination. Let me go down on record as saying that I don't think I know anyone who would actually want, because it's so hard, housing's so hard to afford in our town, and you know this, Professor. It really costs a lot. You got to make a lot of sacrifices to buy a house and to pay your mortgage. And I just don't know many families that think, oh, how wonderful, we're going to take some people from under a freeway underpass and put them in the backyard. But you say you are one of those people.
What I'm telling you is that the report details a number of different cities which have very detailed plans, including some incentives for homeowners, which can include things like actually owning the structure after a certain period of time, and that there are very detailed screening and matching procedures that are being experimented with in these different states. And so it's not simply a matter of just someone tossing up a tent in your backyard.
Okay, so
that's not what these programs are about. It's not a dating app. What it is a very detailed, well thought out innovation to see if there's ways that we can increase affordable housing stock and address the homelessness crisis by using accessory dwelling units.
I know you've studied this, and you've had a whole core of experts with the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University who have looked into this. Do you have a range estimate of how much it would cost to place each individual in someone's backyard?
I don't have that number for you, no. I can tell you that a number of the cities that have looked into these case studies would be perfect places to ask.
But you don't have any idea how much it's cost these cities who have looked into it already?
No, because each city has a different project, so I can't give you a range for what it would cost, because each city has a different structural design, different tax and zoning regulations, different ideas about how these projects would be funded.
Let me ask you this, because as you know the city of Seattle, there are some neighborhoods where homes are very close to one another. Should a neighbor, or maybe neighbors on both sides, have something to say before you establish a little homeless shelter in your backyard?
So it's not a homeless shelter; it's a home. But what I can tell you is that each of these projects has different approaches, and part of those different approaches involve how they are going to deal with surrounding community concerns and how they're going to incorporate the concerns and also the buy-in of the surrounding neighbors so that the project will be successful.
Right. Okay. You also suggest authorized encampments. Sarah Rankin, we're talking about various solutions for the homeless crisis, and what you're saying is the ultimate solution is affordable housing and building more affordable housing. The question is, what steps would you actually take to actually take some of the people off the streets and out of the parks and out of the freeway underpasses, and because they seem to be everywhere today, and place them into this now affordable housing? What exactly is the plan?
Well, Seattle doesn't have a particularly coherent plan. What we need to do And this has been proven not just by the studies that our own Homeless Rights Advocacy Project has done, but a number of other entities across the country have shown that the most effective method of dealing with homelessness is through affordable housing, specifically something called Housing First. And here in Seattle, we have demonstrated that quite famously in the 1811 East Lake Project. That program housed 95
drunk, right?
Well, I don't care for the phrase, but it's a location that housed 95 people who are chronically homeless, many
alcoholics.
Many of whom.
But they have to be alcoholics to qualify, right? As I understood it, when that project, because it's right up the street from where I'm broadcasting right now, it's right here. And we investigated it, and in order to qualify to get into that East Lake project, you had to have a history of drunk and disorderly arrests. You actually had to have a real documented alcoholic homeless problem.
Well, those are two different things, showing that you've got a history of arrest or showing that you have a problem with alcoholism. But what I will say is that program housed 95 people who are chronically homeless and provided them with permanent supportive housing for 1 year. And an extensive study of that program showed that in just its first year, it saved taxpayers $4 million. Utah and several other states across the country are part of a national Housing First effort that has resulted in well over $1 billion of savings in taxpayer money, and that's just as of 2015, the last time I checked.
Okay, my question is that, and this is really a question that was particularly strong about the East Lake Project. I won't call it drunk dorms because you object to that title, but that they allow people to continue drinking when they come there. And I remember the first year what operated, they had several people who drank themselves to death in this project. What is the message we're sending to people when we say that when you completely destroy your life and you are basically a homeless alcoholic living on the street, we'll take care of you and allow you to continue drinking? Isn't that rewarding extraordinarily negative behavior?
What we know from Housing First is that we have to stop changing our blame first and then house second approach. If we approach homelessness the way that we have in the past, which is to expect people to be as perfect as I assume that each of us assumes that we are, in order to deserve housing, we will continue to have the same.
But when you say when you say deserve housing, who pays for it? Who should pay for it?
Well, I'll tell you what, even if you don't provide permanent supportive housing for people who need that stability and actually who, once given that stability, do fix their own lives, that's what each of the Housing First evaluations shows, is that if you provide people housing first, they have the stability that they need in order to start fixing their own lives. If you don't do that, we're still paying more. And that's also been documented in numerous studies that shows that when we fail to provide adequate, affordable housing and when we prioritize criminal justice as the primary means of responding to homelessness, that is the most expensive and the least effective way of dealing with the homelessness crisis.
You say the least effective way, I mean, where have been conspicuous successes for any of these programs? Clearly not here in Seattle. It's gotten enormously worse. I just read yesterday that in Los Angeles County, they believe the population of homeless has increased by 26% compared to 2016. So where has it worked? Where have any of these programs really taken people off the streets?
Utah, New Mexico, even throughout the city of Houston, they have documented huge gains, not just in terms of the impact that it's had on the people who have been housed in Housing First programs, but also in terms of the cost savings. You have to understand that when people live on the street, like I said, what ends up happening is we generate far more expensive ways of making sure that they are going to stay on the street because we drag them through the criminal justice system. They are the highest users of emergency healthcare, of emergency room services. all of those things still cost taxpayers. So you can choose to spend your money one way or another. You
can choose to spend it
by incarcerating people.
No one's talking about incarcerating people right now. But
well, they are being incarcerated.
I know. But again, I believe that you would find many, many, many citizens who would be willing to buy in with some of your suggestions and some of these approaches and even building housing or shelter for people if it was combined with a zero tolerance policy for sleeping in public. In other words, this used to be the case, and I suspect you're very well aware that once upon a time they enforced vagrancy laws. You couldn't sleep in public parks. You couldn't sleep on benches. It is why when I was a little boy growing up in the city of Philadelphia, which was not a wealthy city like Seattle, you never saw homeless people.
Oh, those laws are still being enforced in
but not here. They have encampments everywhere. You can go to Ravenna Park. You go to Cal Anderson Park. There are homeless people everywhere as far as the eye can see. Let's say we build a whole bunch of affordable housing. We build the 14,000 affordable housing units that they're talking about for the city of Seattle. Would those and if you can, I just want to get to the essence of how this would actually address the problem of people sleeping in parks. So you've built these housing units. They would be owned by the city, is that right?
Again, there's a variety of different ways that Housing First, if you're talking about Housing First or talking about affordable housing, those are two sort of different things.
Okay, let's talk about a Housing Firster. So you've built some affordable units somewhere.
Which happen in many different ways. There's many different ways that they're funded. What I can tell you and what I would suggest to your readers is that they look at the numerous studies that have shown the effectiveness of Housing First approaches. And what we know is that we need to invest in bringing Housing First to scale. If people, all of us have a shared interest in solving the homelessness problem, whether you are someone experiencing homelessness.
Okay, again, if we could just focus on some of the problems that I'm having, and I'm just using my my position right now to try to get to that focus. Okay, once you've gotten this housing built, you've seen all the stories, and there have been abundant stories in the Seattle Times, and every newspaper in the country, of homeless people refusing to go to available shelter beds because there are empty beds all the time in the city of Seattle. And people choose not to go. And constant reports. I've spoken to police officers who have had to deal with this. How do you then persuade some of the people who are currently in tents or living in their cars or wherever who may be reluctant to go into some of this Housing First housing that's been built? How do you actually persuade them to go there?
Okay, so I'm determined to let you let me answer a question entirely. So now that you've asked one. The first we have to acknowledge, I know you say that there's shelter beds that are available all the time. There's really no clear and reliable way to notify people of those openings or to timely transport them there. So even if there was that clear and reliable method of identifying those openings, we have to understand the extraordinary gauntlet of obstacles that people face in successfully accessing shelter. Me, I have a 15-year-old son. Most of the shelters in this area would require me to split up from my son, and I'm not going to do that, as I assume most of your readers would not. I know you have children and that you're married. You wouldn't want to split up from your wife either, but you would have to if you're going to access any number of the shelters that are in the Seattle area that have openings. For others, that means they don't want to split up from beloved pets, from what little personal belongings they have. And if you've ever been through the admissions process of a shelter, you'll see that people are really subjected to a long list of conditions that most of us would perceive as significant sacrifices of our sense of human dignity, privacy, autonomy. And for many,
such as
these are the most prized possessions that people can ask. What your sexual orientation is, whether you've had any partners recently who have any particular
diseases.
You know, what your health is, you know, whether
okay,
you have
so how do you so again, what you're saying is none of this would be asked. Would the housing be made available in the Housing First model without conditions? In other words, just come live here and for how long?
The Housing First programs They vary. Again, I keep saying this, but it's because we want cities, right? Especially,
right.
I'm sure your listeners want cities to be able to have local solutions
sure.
to local problems. So there's a variety of different approaches to how long folks can or should stay. We know that it's unlikely, for example, for people to succeed from one night of emergency shelter because of the lack of likelihood that they're going to have any sort of stability from sleeping among next to a bunch of strangers for one night.
It has to be more than one night. I understand that. But again, there is so much that needs to be continued with this conversation. I salute you for your very clear statement in this report that throwing money at the problem is not a simple solution.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy your podcast, take a moment, tell a friend to subscribe today.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.